the three key words that guided peace activist Philip Berrigan.
He started to use three words more than others, and they were resistance, revolution, and liberation. And these three words were appearing again and again in his writings, and I began to realize that they were a journey that Phil had undertaken, that once you embrace nonviolent resistance, you recognize the need for total nonviolent revolution in this country, because the country, Phil felt, couldn't be reformed. It was going to have to be rebuilt, and that would require a nonviolent revolution. And once you embrace those two facts, you would achieve this liberation, both physically, spiritually, and morally liberated, that there was nothing the state could really do to you. They could imprison your body, and you can embrace voluntary poverty and have nothing, but they cannot take anything away from you because you have this liberation, you have this faith, you have this belief in humanity.
That's Brad Wolf. We talk with him about A Ministry of Risk. It's the collection of writings of Philip Berrigan Wolf edited and wrote the introduction for. Then we talk with Noel Hernandez Gonzalez about his translation of Rodrigo Blanco Calderón's novel Simpatía. Long listed for the Booker Prize, it's about chaos in Venezuela and the collapse of Chavismo. And finally, we hear William Bronston read a powerful excerpt from Public Hostage, Public Ransom. It's his memoir about shutting down the notorious Willowbrook State School for the Intellectually Disabled and how that changed America. We air the full interview with Bronston next week. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. From the battlefields of World War II to the front lines of peace activism, Philip Berrigan evolved from soldier to scholar, priest to political prisoner. Confronting the fundamental nature of America's military-focused culture, Berrigan took an unyielding stance against the social evils of war, systemic racism, unchecked materialism, and the existential threat of nuclear weapons. A Ministry of Risk is the definitive collection of Philip Berrigan's writings, edited with an introduction by my guest, Brad Wolf. Wolf is executive director and co-founder of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. A former lawyer, prosecutor, professor, and community college dean, he writes for various publications. Brad Wolf, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me. It's so good to be here.
So this book, Ministry of Risk, is a collection of writings on peace and nonviolence by Philip Berrigan. First, just introduce us to Berrigan. He came from a working-class progressive background, followers of the Catholic Worker. Tell us about his family and where he came from.
So Philip Berrigan was a Depression-era baby, as you indicated, hardscrabble family. And he went to World War II, and he wanted to go to World War II, was very patriotic, very enthusiastic. According to his own writings, wanted to kill as many Nazis as he could. But when he went there and saw combat and participated in combat, it left him very disillusioned. So when he returned home from World War II, he went through this period of discernment where he was trying to figure out what he was going to do with his life and how he was going to reconcile his Catholic faith with what he had seen and done in World War II. And that led him to the priesthood. He became a Josephite priest, and he picked that particular order because it was dedicated to serving African Americans. And he had witnessed really awful discrimination in the armed services of the U.S. military. So he wanted to work in African American communities, and that's what he did. In the 1950s, became a civil rights activist and eventually an anti-war activist in the 1960s, and then a political prisoner for his nonviolent resistance to war. And over his life, from the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, all the way up until his death in 2002, Philip Berrigan was in and out of prison for a total of 11 years, all for nonviolent resistance to war.
And what drew you to him? Now, I know you're a co-founder of the Peace Action Network that's in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. How did you decide to edit this book? And by the way, I should say, your introduction is really wonderful, as is the preface that was written by his daughter as well.
Thank you so much. And that preface is really beautiful. It's a wonderful tribute that Frieda Berrigan wrote to her father. Very touching. I was drawn to Philip Berrigan because I'm Catholic, born and raised, and was interested in peace and social justice from the time I started college, went to law school, became a prosecutor because I wanted to work with victims of violence, but soon realized that all I was doing was sending people to prison and I was really not helping. So I became involved in other aspects of social justice and anti-war efforts. And Philip Berrigan, when I first discovered his writings, which were long out of print, when I first discovered his writings, I felt a certain affinity or kinship to him because he was very direct, very forceful in what he was saying. His brother, Daniel Berrigan, was a wonderful poet, and I loved his books. But I found Phil's personality to be one I could relate to. And so wanted to try to get Phil's writings back into print because I thought what he had to say was so important. And I thought his life was such a wonderful example of how each of us can undertake a ministry of risk and do something to ease the suffering of those around us.
And what about his personality drew you to him?
You know, I'm in Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and so I'm in a lot of different peace groups here. And many of my colleagues are Mennonites, Quakers, Brethren, and they've really walked the walk always. You know, they're from the historic peace churches. And so they're wonderful, peace-loving, gentle folks. And as a Catholic, I came from kind of this sharp-elbowed family of, you know, seven of us, and everybody's kind of a little rough, and so was my father. And Phil comes across that way, very plain-spoken, very direct, you know, sort of military. He's forceful. He can be domineering at times. He would, you know, tend to push people a little too hard, but was also aware of that. So I just saw, well, here's somebody who can be a peacemaker and yet doesn't necessarily have all the attributes that I normally associate with sort of the Gandhi peacemakers. This is sort of an everyday guy's guy that I was able to relate to, who was a wonderful writer and a very brave and vocal critic of the U.S. empire and of militarism.
Yeah, that's true. Now, ministry, of course, it relates to the fact that he was a father. He was a priest. Talk about the spiritual roots of Philip Berrigan's resistance and the influence of Thomas Merton on him.
The spiritual roots are central to Phil's life, to his witness, to his work. It was everything, really. He read the gospel every day, all his life. And when you read his handwritten journals, he would remark about something he had read in the gospel, something he must have read thousands of times by that point, but would nevertheless see new insights into what he had read that day. So it not only grounded him, but it guided him. And he asked this question of himself constantly, which was, what does Christ ask of me? And that question haunted him, it drove him, it compelled him to go into the breach with the victims and to stand with the victims. So he took Christ, Martin Sheen at Phil Berrigan's funeral said, Phil Berrigan took Jesus personally. And I think that's true. He took the gospel personally and he lived it personally. And it was this wonderful integration of faith and reality in Phil's life that really attracted me to him. Because for the first time for me, I saw my Catholic faith really being put into action on a daily basis. And I thought, oh, this is the way it's supposed to work. Here's a man who actually put the faith into action on a daily basis.
And you say also that he was a hopeful realist. I mean, you talk about his pragmatism. What do you mean by that?
Well, often it's as a peacemaker, you can be cast as idealistic or naive, vague, sometimes just academic. But Phil was very nuts and bolts. You know, he was very much practical and pragmatic in what he wanted to accomplish. He was an organizer, a mobilizer, and was very good at it. So when he would assess a nonviolent action, he would consider all sides of how the action would be best staged, how to organize it, who would be where, and what you might accomplish by this. So when he would go into the draft file offices to either burn the files or pour blood on the draft files during the Vietnam War, he not only planned it out in a very pragmatic way, but he thought, what effect is this going to have on the anti-war movement in the country? And will this stimulate discussion around the American dinner table if we do this? So very practical, very pragmatic, very results oriented in that.
And he had a huge impact. I mean, you mentioned the draft action. Talk a little bit more about that. I mean, since you mentioned it, we'll start there, but I want to go back also to some of his earlier activism after we talk about this. So talk about the Baltimore Four. I believe that was his first action. Is that right?
It was. It was his first draft board action. You know, in the early 60s, he had been out at protests and vigils. And, you know, he had actually had conversations with high level government officials to try to convince them of the errors of the Vietnam War. But none of that was working. And so Phil realized he was going to have to take a different approach. And that approach was going to be nonviolent resistant actions. And so he and three of his colleagues in October of 1967 went into a selective service office where they keep the hard copy draft files of young men. And those files were what would conscript those young men to be sent to Vietnam to kill. And Phil and his colleagues went in there, and Phil was wearing his Roman collar as a priest, you know, dressed as a priest as he was, and went in and they removed the files from the drawers and they poured blood on the files. Now it was part human blood and part animal blood that they had mixed with it. And they did that, number one, to destroy the files, but number two, it was a very symbolic action to demonstrate the spilt blood of Vietnamese and Americans in this faraway country, and also the symbolic blood of Christ. And so they were able to pour the blood on the files, and for that one action of destroying a relatively small number of files, Phil received a 6-year prison sentence.
And was that unusual?
That was a pretty stiff sentence. It really was. When you consider other sentences for people who are engaged in other criminal activities, I think the government was clearly trying to send a message to anti-war activists. We're going to silence you and we're going to put you in prison because speaking against the empire and the wars of the empire is not going to be tolerated. And these are the parallels that you see in Phil's life and the life of Christ, where, you know, the same with Christ, speaking up against the empire is going to be charged and tried and eventually killed for his crimes.
And we're speaking on a day actually when Julian Assange has just pled guilty to one felony and will be sentenced to time served. But yes, he was facing 175 years. So, there is a special kind of hell that is reserved for political prisoners in this country.
There is. When you speak truth to power, you're going to pay in this country. And Julian Assange, yes, he gets time served. He gets to go home now. But the ordeal that he went through over the last 15 years was extraordinary. And the government never denied anything that Julian Assange was false. They didn't claim it was false. He released what was true. And the same is accurate of Phil Berrigan and Dan Berrigan, and who are simply speaking the truth but are sent to prison for it.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Brad Wolf about A Ministry of Risk. It's a collection of writings on peace and nonviolence by Philip Berrigan, edited by Wolf and out from Fordham University Press. So actually, let's go back a little bit earlier, because he did not start out in the anti-war movement. He started out in the civil rights movement. And in fact, Stokely Carmichael, the Black Power leader, said that Phil Berrigan was, quote, the only white man who knows where it's at. So tell us about that, and how did he gain that level of trust?
It is a stunning comment, considering he's talking about a white middle-aged Catholic priest in the United States. So Phil's background in civil rights, again, it came from him joining the Josephite Order of the Catholic Priests. And in the mid-50s, he was assigned to African-American neighborhoods, communities, as a priest, as a teacher. And he immediately would go into these neighborhoods and start organizing because he was appalled at the living conditions they were forced to exist in. So he would organize against landlords, slum tenant landlords, and he would organize against the fact that they were discriminated against for jobs. And each time he would do this, the particular diocese that he was in would try to silence him and would move him somewhere else. And so Phil would get moved from New York to Baltimore to New Orleans to Newburgh, and they kept moving him around to try to silence him. But of course, Phil's not going to be silenced on these issues of humanity. So he continued to speak out. And he began to realize very early on that there was this link that Martin Luther King later spoke about in 1967. There was this link between racism, militarism, and materialism, and they were inextricably linked. And he wanted to try to bring that out in his actions and in his writings. And he was able to gain that knowledge in large part from conversations with Dorothy Day, who is of the Catholic Worker, and understood how that system worked. So it was natural that Phil would move from civil rights activism into anti-war activism because those two are so inextricably linked.
You know, I lived in Baltimore at the time that he was there with a Jonah House, and I remember the enormous respect that those of us who came out of the anti-war movement felt for the incredible courage and sacrifice of both Philip and Daniel Berrigan. So tell us about his anti-war actions beyond the draft board. Talk about the Catonsville Nine.
Sure. So Phil does the action in Baltimore, for which he receives a 6-year sentence. But before he can begin serving that sentence, Phil realizes that he needs to conduct another action, even bigger, because he wants to stimulate that conversation around the American dinner table, get people talking about the war in Vietnam. So before he can start that sentence, he organizes the Catonsville Nine, which is an action that occurs in early 1968, the spring of 68, where they select another Selective Service office and they go in. And this time they use homemade napalm to pour on the files. And again, very symbolic, very carefully thought in terms of the message that they're sending. Napalm, of course, was being dropped on Vietnamese civilians at that time. It's this fiery jelly that burns all the way to the bone. And so they had concocted a recipe of their own, and they took 400 draft files out into the parking lot. They had notified the media, and they poured the homemade napalm on the files, burning all of these files. That drew enormous attention, international attention, and it also drew a much stiffer prison sentence for Phil. I think most people after the Baltimore action would have tried to keep a low profile and not do anything else, but Phil knew he was going to have to risk even more if he was going to try to bring an end to this war, or at least participate in some way to having a conversation about the war.
And, you know, this is a book of his writings. What do you feel it is in his character that enabled him to conduct this ministry of risk, to take such risks, to risk his very freedom, as a matter of fact, and he also lived a life of voluntary poverty? What was it about him that made this course of action the one he had to take?
Certainly his faith played an enormous role in that. And then his experiences in World War II played a big role. But as I was reading all of Phil's writings, and I noticed he started to use three words more than others, and they were resistance, revolution, and liberation. And these three words were appearing again and again in his writings. And I began to realize that they were a journey that Phil had undertaken, that once you embrace nonviolent resistance, you recognize the need for total nonviolent revolution in this country, because the country, Phil felt, couldn't be reformed. It was going to have to be rebuilt, and that would require a nonviolent revolution. And once you embrace those two facts, You would achieve this liberation, both physically, spiritually, and morally liberated, that there was nothing the state could really do to you. They could imprison your body, and you can embrace voluntary poverty and have nothing, but they cannot take anything away from you because you have this liberation, you have this faith, you have this belief in humanity. I think that freed Philip Berrigan to take these risks that many of us would not take. And I think that gave him the courage to continue to go on and push these issues.
You said that he thought that America both held the seeds of its own destruction and the seeds of its own liberation at the same time. So connect the dots for us from what you've just said to his thought more generally about America.
He thought American society was, as he would put it, spiritually sick. They were spiritual cadavers. For many of us as we go about our lives, because we turn a blind eye to much of the suffering that's going on in the world. We turn a blind eye to so much of our tax dollars being spent on war and on nuclear weapons that could destroy the world. We just shut that out. And that turns us into these spiritual cadavers. And those are the seeds of our own destruction, our affluence, our ignorance, our somnambulance, but we also have the seeds of our own liberation. There's a rich history of nonviolent resistance in the United States, going all the way back to the Boston Tea Party. And he felt that Americans had a responsibility and an ability to actually step up and make the necessary changes if they understood, if they had the information, and if they were liberated in the same kind of way, liberated from their affluence. Phil would say that Americans are brutalized by affluence. And I think that's true. So many of us are kept in a state of fear of losing our comfortable life or our safety and security that we are afraid to take chances for our brothers and sisters around the globe who are suffering all too often at the hands of the United States.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think a lot of us struggle with two contradictory images of America. On the one, the Declaration of Independence, the right of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, the democratic ideals, you know, out of many, one, all those things that are really so inspiring and have inspired, in fact, revolutions throughout the world. And on the other hand, the incredible oppression and cruelty that we have visited on other human beings since our very founding. Philip Berrigan, Brad Wolf, in this book, Ministry of Risk, that you've edited of his writings, Philip Berrigan said that our willingness to build nuclear weapons, which, you know, to me, when you really think about it, how insane is that, really? That we are willing to destroy the entire world for what? He said it was a sign of our refusal to become fully human. So what does it mean to become human to Philip Berrigan?
That's such a good question, and it's so central to the writings. You know, Phil was appalled that Americans had been conned into paying for their own destruction through the building of nuclear weapons. This idea of becoming fully human was something that became more and more apparent in my research as I was going through Phil's writings. And what he was getting at was that, again, this idea that Americans have a choice. We can embrace our security and our safety and turn our mind off to a lot of the bad news that's going on in the world. And there's plenty of bad news right now, a lot of suffering and a lot of war. And we can shut that out and we can just go about our lives. But to do that means we're shutting down a part of our humanity. We're becoming sort of these technocratic kind of zombies that the empire may want us to be. And that would not be fully human. To become fully human means you open your heart and you open your mind to all that pain and all that suffering, and you let that come in because that connects you with humanity. And that lets you be a part of humanity. And that lets you stand in the breach with the victims. And then you're becoming fully human. So that is a journey that we should all want to take. It's a bruising journey, but it's a beautiful journey to be liberated and to embrace our humanity fully and become fully human.
That is beautiful. And you yourself, it seems to me, are taking that lesson very much to heart. You have your own project, which is inspired by the work of Philip Berrigan. It's the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal. Tell us about that and how it was inspired by his work.
That is a people's tribunal that I started with two colleagues about 3 years ago. I'm working with Kathy Kelly and Nick Mothern on that. And it's a people's tribunal to hold accountable U.S. weapons manufacturers for war crimes and crimes against humanity, because we believe that weapons manufacturers are driving war for profit, that they're not just innocently responding to requests from the Pentagon, but that they are creating a narrative in the media and in the halls of government that makes the military option seem like the only option. And they're doing that for money, and people around the globe are paying the price of that. So what we've been doing is interviewing witnesses and victims and military officials and military analysts and award-winning journalists and theologians, and recording all of this testimony. And we have an international board of judges who are deliberating on that right now. The tribunal has concluded. We submitted all the evidence just at the beginning of June, and the judges will deliberate on this and render a verdict. And our hope is that this brings a lot of attention to the role weapons manufacturers play in fomenting war. We did things like deliver subpoenas and contempt citations to these weapons manufacturers in Arlington, Virginia. Now, these citations do not have legal force because a people's tribunal is not in the court of law. A people's tribunal is created when the courts have been captured by the criminals, and the citizenry has to rise up and try to hold actors accountable for crimes because the government will not. So that's what we're doing with the Merchants of Death. And we've received a lot of wonderful publicity and attention for this. And that's the goal: inform the public, make people aware of how their tax dollars are being spent and what's going on. And in terms of Phil Berrigan's role in sort of inspiring this, when Phil was in prison in 1971, there was talk of holding a people's tribunal as he was writing letters to his colleagues outside of prison. And they were talking about having a people's tribunal for Vietnam and holding the American government accountable for crimes in Vietnam. And they would get Henry Kissinger to testify. And how would they get Henry Kissinger to testify? And so that kind of discussion influenced my thinking about a people's tribunal. I'm also a lawyer and a former prosecutor, and so the idea of using a legal forum in order to gather a lot of information and communicate it to the public was attractive to me.
Well, that's amazing. And we will link to your website for the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal at Writer's Voice. Brad Wolf, it has just been wonderful to talk with you about this book you edited, The Writings on Peace and Nonviolence by Philip Berrigan. The title is Ministry of Risk. Thanks again.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Brad Wolf is executive director and co-founder of Peace Action Network of Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Find a link to the Merchants of Death War Crimes Tribunal at writersvoice.net. Next up, a gripping novel about the breakdown of Venezuelan society in the wake of Chavismo. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. When Hugo Chavez came to power in 1999, there were great hopes that his populist government would finally address the poverty and corruption that plagued Venezuela. And at least for poverty, it did, at first. But by the time Chavez died in 2013, corruption had hollowed out the promise of his reign. With the succession of Nicolas Maduro, the breakdown of Venezuelan society and its descent into authoritarianism only accelerated. Rodrigo Blanco Calderón's celebrated novel Simpatia is set in the Venezuela of Nicolás Maduro. A mass exodus of the intellectual class has resulted in thousands of pets left behind. The abandonment of pets is a metaphor for the abandonment of the people of Venezuela by their government. But it also drives the plot of this gripping novel, which features a protagonist who sets out to save the abandoned dogs of Venezuela. Our guest is Noel Hernandez Gonzalez. He is co-translator with Daniel Hahn of two novels by Rodrigo Blanco Calderón, The Night and Simpatía. Originally from Spain, he lives in the UK. Noel Hernandez Gonzalez, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
You are the translator of this wonderful novel, Simpatía, set in Venezuela in the present day under the current regime of Nicolas Maduro. First, tell us about the title, Simpatía. What does it mean in Spanish, and what does it mean in relationship to the novel itself?
It's a tricky question. And the title, that is the reason we didn't translate the title into English. It's because the meanings aren't quite the same. So the novel itself has that definition from the Royal Spanish Academy Dictionary. And we have left that for the English reader to have an idea, a sense of the word. And that's why we have left it in Spanish. We didn't translate that into English. And in a way, it could be translated like sympathy, but not quite either. So in Spanish, it can be the affection you have, an affective inclination between people. And it also the relationship between two bodies. I'm just reading the definition here by the Spanish Academy, but I'm going to read the definition then. So as a noun, it's an affective inclination between people, generally spontaneous and mutual. It's also an affective inclination towards animals or things, which is, applicable to the novel. And it's also the manner of being and character of a person that makes him attractive or agreeable to others.
Right, like the word simpatico.
Yes, exactly. So I guess it's the same root there. So there you go. So there is a bit of simpatico, I guess, a bit of sympathy.
Now, you mentioned the relationship in the novel. So it does refer to a foundation that is at the heart of the plot, a foundation for taking care of animals who have been abandoned by the wholesale abandonment of their country by many people who are leaving Venezuela as a result of the situations there. So it is a Simpatía por el Perro Foundation, sympathy for the dog. Tell us about the situation. Tell us about the conditions that surround this novel. Why are people abandoning their dogs? Also, zoo animals are getting abandoned and livestock are getting abandoned. And dogs are also getting killed. So what's going on here?
So the situation in Venezuela at the moment, they have been living through a crisis for I don't know how long now, but more than 10 years, I guess. And the situation is not getting any better. And a lot of people are leaving the country. Like, we're talking about really big numbers here of people leaving the country. Of course, everyone who can leaves, so we're starting from the upper to the middle classes. And a situation I wasn't aware of, but what they're doing is to leave their pets behind. One of the things that is described in the novel is how the families, once they finish all the bureaucracy, all the paperwork necessary to leave the country, from taking the children out of the school to going to the doctors in Venezuela for the last time, etc. The last thing is to leave the pets and abandon. This is one of the situations the novel focuses on. It's on a practical level, yes, but also it has some metaphorical connotations, obviously, as well.
Yeah, so say something about those metaphorical connotations.
In the way I see it, well, I see it at three levels there. The novel talks about the fact that people are leaving the pets behind. Also, there is a lot of talk in the novel about being an orphan. The protagonist, Ulysses, he is an orphan. Another main character there, his father-in-law, is also an orphan. So we have two levels there of being an orphan, an abandoned dog, an abandoned person, in a way abandoned, and then that can be perhaps applicable to the whole of all the citizens in Venezuela, in a way they're being abandoned by the ruling class, by the people in power. That is the way I read it anyway.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that situation. You know, Hugo Chavez came into power really promising, and in many cases, I thought, delivering a betterment of the poor and working classes. I know that there was a time in which there, you know, I would read reports of lots of social programs that were put in. But that doesn't seem to be the case now. This novel really describes a situation of entrenched corruption in the country, dictatorship, actually, total impunity on the part of the authorities who just, you know, attack anybody they want to and do what they want. How did it devolve from the beginning to now? I mean, or was it always corrupt to begin with?
That is a question I can't really comment on because I'm not from Venezuela. I don't have all the context. I can only comment on what the novel is about, the same as his previous novel as well, Rodrigo's The Night, which again was about contemporary Venezuela, a little before this one, when Hugo Chavez was in power. And yeah, there is a lot of commentary on the current situation with Simpatia, with The Night, about the previous situation. But again, it's about crisis, about the way the people in power aren't looking after, you know, the citizens as they should, the corruption, the fear of having a kind of a police state, and also how the neighbors turn into each other. So it's, you know, it reminds me of Stasi in East Germany and in the 80s, for example.
And is Calderon, does he live in Venezuela, still live there?
No, he lives in Malaga in Spain. He's been living there for a couple of years. He was living in Caracas, Venezuela, then in Paris, and then he moved to Spain.
And you're from Spain?
I am from Spain, but I've been living in the UK for the last 19 years.
So now back to Simpatia. The book really, it references, of course, the conditions that you just described are a backdrop, but the novel is a very close focus on a particular story, a particular family, including the son-in-law and father-in-law. So tell us a little bit about the main character, starting with Ulysses Khan, the protagonist, and his father-in-law, General Martin Ayala.
Mm-hmm. I'll tell you about the story a bit, about the plot. So the novel starts with its main character, as you say, Ulysses Khan, who is middle class, middle age. And the novel starts by telling you how the day he received a text message from his wife saying that she was leaving the country and also leaving him. He comes to tell you that everyone, all of his friends are leaving the country as well, that everyone who can leaves the country, he's staying behind. Then he starts telling you about his relationship with his father-in-law, Martin, who is also, because Ulysses, his job is to teach in a film appreciation workshop. So, and his father-in-law is also a real film aficionado. And in fact, his dogs are called Sonny, Michael, and Fredo, like the children in The Godfather. One of the many references to Coppola in the novel. So his father-in-law eventually dies, and he leaves Ulysses in his will the apartment, the luxury apartment where he's living at, with the condition of him to set up a foundation, a charity, as a dog shelter in his house. So it's a big project. There is a deadline, and the plot gets going, and there are a lot of obstacles in the way for him to get to set up that foundation. And yeah, in the plot, you see people with different interests.
Yeah, and so talk about the dogs. I mean, you have said something about them in terms of simpatia and the abandonment of dogs, you know, metaphorically in the novel. But they play also a real role in the plot. And it's a role that has a through line from all the way back to Simón Bolívar, who was El Libertador, you know, the great independence fighter for Latin America, who was also an orphan, I learned, and had this almost a legendary dog. And so there is a dog who is central to the father-in-law, Martín Ayala, as well as another one that comes in for the protagonist, Ulysses. So tell us a little bit about these dogs.
I'll tell you about all the dogs I remember in the story, because there are many. I don't know if you remember, there is a mention to this dog, called Thor.
Thor. There was, that's right. Yeah. There was a dog called Thor who was killed by neighbors. Right. Yeah. Start there.
Who was killed by the police or the army? Yes, and that caused an international outcry. Intellectuals from Spain, from other countries, were condemning the government because of that attack to the dog who got killed. And so that is one of the important dogs in the novel. Then there is as you mentioned, the Simón Bolívar's dog called Nevado. So the story tells you how Nevado died and the pain that Simón Bolívar had when that dog died. And also the very bizarre program that apparently Hugo Chavez put in place to breed that dogs related all the way to Nevado. So in a place in the mountains near Caracas, there is this town, and there was a program there to breed that kind of dog.
A very special kind of a large dog that had to stay in a cool environment.
Yes, that's correct. Exactly. Which is a bit difficult if you go down to Caracas, but in the mountains, it should be cooler. And then is the dog that the protagonist, Ulysses, gets towards the middle of the end of the novel as well. It's quite important as well for him.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Noel Hernández González, translator of Rodrigo Blanco Calderón's new novel, Simpatía. It's really, I found it a very beautiful novel, completely engrossing. I mean, I read it as much as I could, all in one go. And I wanted to ask you about the process of translation. You know, recently I interviewed a translator who has written her own novel. The novel is The Extinction of Irina Rey. I interviewed Jennifer Croft, who is a translator. She's the translator of Olga Tokarczuk, who is a Polish Nobel Prize winner. And her novel, yes, and her novel is all about translation. So I got very interested in translation. I wanted to ask you, this is translated by by you and by somebody else that you were working with, Daniel Hahn. So first of all, what was it like for you, from your perspective, to translate this novel? This is the second one that you've, of Calderon's novels that you've translated, and to do it with somebody else. Did that change things?
I'll tell you a bit about my story with Daniel and the other translator, and with Blanco Calderon. So Daniel has translated more than 50 books. He's one of the best out there. And very generously, he offered me to co-translate the first book by Rodrigo Blanco Calderon, The Night, because we have met before, and he knew that I was very interested in translating Blanco Calderon. And so he gave me the opportunity to do it with him. And about the process itself, the way we have done it with these two novels, The Night and Sympatia, I do the first draft. It takes me a couple of months. Then he goes over it. Then we get together and go through the problems, the questions we have, etc. And from that, it's a back and forth. We constant communication, emails, draft here, draft there. So a lot of versions of the draft there. And finally, when we are happy with it, but still there are things like we can't solve, we have sent it to them, to the writer, to Rodrigo. And again, he's been really helpful and always happy to give us a hand with what we don't. With the problems where we want more clarity on and we want to really get it right. So yeah, that's been the process. It's like working in separately to start with and then getting together.
Well, it strikes me that it's almost perfect in a way to have the two of you, because Daniel Hahn is a native English speaker. You are a native Spanish speaker. I've been involved, many years ago. My father was Dutch, and my half-stepbrother, Dutch half-stepbrother, was working and publishing a book on Turkey. It was a travel book, and he had it translated into, a Dutch person translated it into English. And he asked me to look it over, and I found it just rife with errors. I mean, just things you would never say if you were a native English speaker. So I really changed things quite a bit. And yet on the other hand, of course, you know the Dutch words. In a way, it seems like it might be very advantageous to have a native speaker of the original language on the one hand and a native speaker of the translation language. Is that true? And is that something you've seen elsewhere?
No, this is not something that usually happens. As you say, I think it would be the ideal scenario to have two translators, one, a native Spanish speaker in this case and a native English. But I think the process of producing this book, regardless of our pair of languages, it goes through so many stages, and the editing is so, so thorough, and that it wouldn't be the case that you would have something that an English speaker wouldn't say, because, as I said, it goes through an editor, it goes through a proofreader. So there are so many stages there. I guess it will depend of the novel we're talking about and all the publishing house and the resources that they are available. But in this case, working with a Seven Stories Press is being a really professional, thorough process. So I don't see something like that happening.
Oh, that's great. That's great to know. So if there was one big challenge for you in the translation process, what was it?
I can't remember a specific problem with this book in particular. It's a kind of a straightforward story. And of course, there are problems, but I can't remember nothing specifically. But I'll tell you what, with the previous novel, The Night, it has a lot of wordplay, a lot of puzzles, a lot of, from palindromes to you know, all kind of word puzzles, and it was really hard to get that into English, obviously. But yeah, we managed, and we're really happy with the result as well.
And Calderon is, Blanco Calderon is also really happy because he credits you in the acknowledgments as the truest last editor of his book.
That is really, really generous of him as well. Yeah, that was, he is happy with us.
Well, it's just a wonderful read. So the book is The Novel is Simpatia by Rodrigo Blanco Calderon, and we've been talking with the translator, Noel Hernandez Gonzalez, and thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Simpatia is out from Seven Stories Press. September 17, 1987, marked the birth of a new era for New Yorkers with developmental disabilities as Governor Mario Cuomo declared the Willowbrook State School on Staten Island officially and forever closed. But that decision didn't just impact New Yorkers. It sparked the closing of such facilities, rife with horrific abuse and violence, all over the country. Next week, we talk with a man who started it all, Dr. William Bronston. In his book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom, Ending Institutional America, he tells a spellbinding tale of how he shut Willowbrook down and what that long-ago fight means for all Americans facing our privatized system of warehousing the disabled and elderly today. Bronston read an excerpt from his book for us, and we bring you that segment now.
There are four photo chapters in the book, and I've grouped the photo chapters not for spectacle and not for grotesqueness, but to show people the violence of institutional living. And I've tried to explain at the head of each of the four chapters. One is called The Radiator, one is called Living Death Alone, one is called Injuries. There are four major chapters. So what I'd like to do is to read you the page and a half introduction to the Radiator chapter, which is the first photo chapter in the book. Seeing takes time. We live in a fast society, 30 miles an hour at least. What we see is so often like a billboard, colors, shapes, a quick message among an avalanche of quick messages, numbing. It doesn't take long to withdraw from all that for most of us. There's only so much one can sort out, understand, emotionally recognize, respond to, use. For a health worker, seeing, really seeing, is critical. Each time an opportunity arises to see, every sense must be alert. Every bit of experience and stored knowledge must be somewhere close at hand. Each time that one only half sees, is blind to what one sees, misinterprets, makes false assumptions, or has incorrect expectations, a life is at stake. I don't want to romanticize the doctor or add to the mystique and awe in which medicine is held in the minds of people. Seeing is not any more than a good parent or a loving and dedicated worker does all the time naturally. But this is a problem for the professional who is trained to be detached and alienated from people. Quote, objectivity, unquote, is the cover term. It is a real chore for the professional to be natural, alert, and insightful, and identify with people rather than functioning in a role, in a status pose, flowing from authority, from fail-safe aspirations, possibly from even downright dislike of people and human service work. If the feeling of identification between server and served is underdeveloped, sabotaged, or absent, seeing is arduous. Seeing, really seeing, requires feeling. It is the difference between human understanding and object spectating. It is intensely hard to see in the institution all the deafening language of images built from the physical remoteness, steel doors, barren rooms, overcrowding, accepted suffering, and degradation make it almost impossible to see, to feel, and identify with the victims as peers, citizens, friends. friends, people. I guess it was the minute-to-minute struggle to see that made work so exhausting. I don't think that anyone can naturally identify with the people trapped in the institution without constant conscious effort to redefine everything and fight back the tendency to withdraw and close out what is really there to be seen and done. On all wards, there is nothing soft. The stone floors, wood and fiberglass chairs, formica and chrome tables, steel and glass windows, iron beds, hardness, coldness, hardness unyielding, no place soft, no place for warmth, solace, sanctuary, energy to support life, no place but one, the radiator. There, for the lonely, the searcher, the instinctual migrant, is a place 4 feet long and 3 feet high, an iron-covered plate radiating something drastically different from all the rest. One has but to be passively close to feel warmth, a sensation, a tingle on the skin, on the nerve endings of one's being. There for the lonely, it took me a long time to realize how important the radiator was to a community of people who had nothing. Once I saw the people huddling there, it still took time to really grasp, to feel the profound meaning of the radiator. At first, I was outraged at the burns that I saw. People drugged with a slowly diminished ability to feel sought the radiator for a retreat, a sleeping companion, a mother fragment, then burned, were unable to move. Couldn't the workers watch out for the people next to the hot plates? I didn't realize how powerful was the pull to crouch and curl up there. A pull that which draws all life to the warmth and energy of the sun which was here cut off. Here there was only the paint peeling unmodulated sheet of hot metal left. Can you imagine how empty, how deprived life can be, how empty of warmth? How can we not really see? How can we let the radiator be the sun for so many? There is always some sort of radiator, some obvious substitute for the real thing around which the lives of the public hostages cling. We just have to look with more than just our eyes.
William Bronston, reading from his book, Public Hostage, Public Ransom. Don't miss our interview with him next week on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. Or go to writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.